Fred Film Radio, Venice Film Festival, Italy.
Good afternoon, everyone. Good afternoon and welcome. By some miracle, this panel actually took place last year between the first and second waves of the COVID-19 pandemic, and we had two brave souls who are here with us today who did come down and did look at just two films. There were only two films ready, but they were very good, very interesting. And that's Sarah Enholm Hjelm in the yellow dress. She was here. And Pierre Eisenreich at the far end from Positif magazine. And this year, the great news is we can welcome back some of our American friends and critics who were traditionally members of this panel, but who could not travel last year. I have Glenn Kenny in the middle there. Glenn Kenny, whose book on Martin Scorsese's Goodfellas has just come out in paperback. It had very good reviews last year when it came out. And then Stephanie Zakarik next to him, the film critic of Time and a nominee for the Pulitzer Prize. And next to her is Chris Wagner, who was for 24 years almost a culture editor of the Dallas Morning News and who writes for the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times and elsewhere. And Pierre Eisenreich, who is from the greatest of all French magazines, Positif. He's been on the editorial board for 20 years and he also produces boxes of classic films on DVD and Blu-ray. I said by some miracle it took place. Well, this year the result is we've been rewarded with six films, and I think the panelists found something of value in all of them, and it's a bunch of films which come from a wide spectrum of environments, places. They're set in the mountains of Ecuador, they're set in the French Pyrenees, they're set in Long Island, they're set in Naples, and they deal with issues of love and violence. They deal with issues of family tensions and reconciliation, and they deal with the clash between the urban environment of today and the deepest countryside and the tranquility that that can bring. I'd like to start with Savina Nairotti, who is the fairy godmother, if I can call you that, of the whole Biennale College Cinema program, which is now in its ninth year. We'll be celebrating the 10th anniversary next year. And Savina, how was it that in this terrible year of the plague, you have managed to bring six films to fruition?
Well, it's their merit, not ours, but still, this was a very particular year because, in fact, we just met with the filmmakers in person here in Venice. So the whole ninth edition was online, so we did it through online workshops. For sure, it wasn't ideal in the sense that we love to be together on our San Servolo Island and enjoy our time together, and we have the two teams from the previous edition that can testify to this. But still, it has been quite special to hold the whole, you know, the whole workshops online. And honestly, it's to them that I say, well, you've been fantastic because they've been able to shoot. And still, COVID was a very big problem this year. What is also very special is that we can this year see the two films from last year that couldn't shoot because that was the beginning of March. It was already a miracle, I think, that we were able to present two films. So the Biennale College has now a group of 30 films in these nine editions, so I'm very proud. Let's see, next year we should reach 34. But also what I wanted to say, and that's again something that I'm very proud of, is that being this a college, it's not only about the films that are made, but about the teams that actually we've been able to help develop their ideas. And I guess at the moment we're with 52 films are out there. Some of them have not been directly financed by the college, but it's still a certain number.
So you've brought them into life, really. You've encouraged them. And have you tracked how successful they've been around the world? I mean,
Yes. Well, in many cases, there's different. Each filmmaker has its own voice, and that's the idea of the college. You will not recognize a college film. I hope you can recognize it because of the quality, but not because you can see a certain form or something that's been repeated, or because there's things that are the same in one film from the other. Yeah. It's very diverse, and that's the best thing. And in many cases, it has launched some careers. In some cases, some films have become cult in their particular country. In other cases, there are cases of extremely successful films that have sold all over the world. So every film has a different story. And what also is very nice is that, of course, collaborations and partnerships are built inside the college, because once you put together teams of filmmakers from all over the world, that's also what you want to happen.
They
know there's somebody out there that can be there for them, whatever happens also in the future. So it's
Glenn, environment is crucial in all these films, isn't it? The way that in some we see how the city life impacts on the emotions of our characters, and in others, like a film like La Tana, The Den, in the deepest countryside, the rural imagery plays a big part.
I think, you know, people often debate nature versus nurture in the lives of human beings, and some people say environment is destiny, but if environment isn't destiny, environment certainly is narrative. So I think each of these films makes very crafty and interesting use of environment. La Santa Piccola focusing very much on this very parochial small town and their ostensible interests versus their actual interests, which become much more clear at the end of the film. With Al Oriente, you have a crucial tectonic shift from a banal city life to a dangerous jungle. In La Tana, the isolation of the rural area is crucial to both the naivete of the male character and the aspiration of the female character to bring her mother to live her last days in a place of peace that she loved. And, of course, the final imagery of the garden growing inside the house is spectacular. With Nuestros Días Más Felices, the characters. And, again, sometimes with these films you can guess that this is a function of budget and production constraints. Certainly in Nuestros Días Más Felices, when the central characters are isolating in that house, you can see this is almost a good situation, you know, for a COVID shoot, such as it is. Mon Père le Diable, again, the French Pyrenees, but, you know, there's above and below. There's the cafe below where the central character is initially unsuccessfully wooed by the bartender, and there's the cottage above where, paradoxically, the most terrible depredations occur. And in Ricky D'Ambrose's The Cathedral, I know Ricky. I've actually worked with him. I've been on his sets, and he's a friend, and he's a filmmaker I admire. And I think this film vaults him from talented and interesting to major voice. So I'm really thrilled to see that. But this is a suburban, semi-urban, suburban world, circumscribed by media. And the compositions are all very tight. You know, it's shot in Academy ratio. It's a boxy frame, but more to that, every frame is controlled, tight. It's not claustrophobic, nor is it like uncomfortably intimate. The distances really are. I think Ricky, when he's doing a shot of two people at a table facing each other, it's just as much about the space between the people as it is about the people, and he cinematically makes that register in a way that honors his influences, which include Bresson, Straub, Huillet, and Godard. So, in every one of these six films, I think environment is acutely felt and beautifully depicted and realized, and it makes a huge difference. I just want to say how happy I am to be back. I've been on the panel since 2015, and for a couple of years during my time on the panel, I wondered aloud about why the Biennale College would even want input from Americans anymore. You know, we're in a situation overseas where Frank Zappa 50 years ago called America a scab of a nation driven insane. And when I listened to that as a child, I thought, yeah, he's overstating a little bit. But nowadays, it feels more real. And I hope as Americans, we can actually continue to contribute something meaningful to the culture through venues such as this. And I'm very proud and happy and grateful to be here.
Yeah. Sarah, when you first arrived a couple of days ago, you said as you went away and to get your accreditation or something that, oh yes, I liked a couple of the films very much. Now, do you want to come out with that and say which were the films that impressed you the most and the films that you think, as a Finnish film critic, would do well in your country?
The ones that were my favorites actually were the Italian films here. Uh-huh. And I think they are the ones that should or could do well also in Finland. Yeah. Latana and this Miracle Child. Yeah. And I think they were very beautifully made and also very shows that the local, if you do something that's quite local, it will translate and work universally too. Yeah. And I was very impressed to hear that they were just the first films of these people, and I think they're very sort of polished also, and sort of they have sort of like all these films. I'm very impressed with the diversity and all these different kinds of style that people have chosen here, and have sort of been very sort of taken their style to the limit and really done them visually and. The acting, I think, is really good, and also the casting of the actors. And I was quite impressed that you see so little, actually, of COVID in these movies, that you really managed to make it sort of...
No masks.
Well, some masks. In Al Orient, there was some masks, and that was also good. But I thought it was sort of very... that they have sort of adapted the stories to the... Yeah. So it feels like the stories are really well made for this purpose in a way. And it didn't feel like the constraints were bigger, which I think I've felt in some other movies, like, you know, Almodovar's last year movie, for instance. Then you felt the constraints sort of constraining him. But now I think it's sort of, it feels like it's organic.
Well, I usually mention in my introductions that each of these films is made on a maximum budget of 150,000 euros. But it's been going so many years that I think we take it for granted. But it still remains amazing that we're sitting here discussing the films as though they were on a par with all the major films in the competition or in the Orizzonti, who had budgets infinitely more. Infinitely bigger than the Biennale College has, but it doesn't stop the quality coming through. Stephanie, when you see films like this compared with the studio pictures that at Time magazine presumably you have to see week in, week out, what's the big contrast for you? What sets these kind of films apart from what you're seeing at home?
Oh, for me, I mean, I love this program and I believe in it wholly. You know, like Glenn, I've been coming for several years, and you know, in these the big budget franchises that I often have to review, I actually see a lack of imagination rather than more ingenuity. You know, given how much money these people have to play with, and when I come here, you know, I have come to think of these films as maxi micro-budget filmmaking, because all of you take whatever elements, whatever resources are available to you, and just expand them into something that feels, you know, completely whole and compelling. And I mean, I have to say, watching this crop, I was just stunned. I mean, I found something to love in all of them. In My Father the Devil, you know, it's a really elegant film about a very difficult subject and about trauma. And I was kind of waiting for, when are we going to see, like, the flashback that shows the terrible things that happened? And it never came. And I felt so relieved because we see so many films that actually punish audiences as a way of, you know, kind of indicating how terrible things are in the world. So, you know, like so much of life, filmmaking is problem solving. And you guys have just found amazing ways of solving the problem of, you know, not having a lot of money, but using the resources. Sunlight, you know, as Glenn was saying, I mean, the farm landscape in Latana is just so, this, you know, gripping setting for this really, you know, intimate drama about, you know, a love story and also about the end of life. And there's one other thing that I have to say about them is, you know, not every film has to have a sex scene, but I see so few good sex scenes in contemporary movies, big budget movies, forget it, they don't even exist. But I just thought that, you know, Latana and there was another one that I loved. Oh, and it, My Father the Devil, there's a, you know, a love scene. I love seeing that, and I feel like that's bringing us back to a kind of essential intimacy that a lot of filmmaking is missing. So again, I just come here and I feel grateful and excited for the future, and excited for the future of all of you, because it means in my job I get to see better movies that hopefully I can eventually write about.
Thank you. Pierre, can we come to the formal aspect of the films? I mean, with a program like this, I think one's always looking as a critic for new ways of expressing oneself cinematically. The films that take us with a jump forward, like Abu Dassouf Godard or Persona Bergman, films that with one leap change the language of cinema. Now, here, I thought it was very interesting, for example, in Latana, the Den, that they used a very 1.166 or even less ratio, and also in the cathedral, that kind of. Did you notice any particular uses of technique in these films which you felt, yes, that's new?
Mainly new narrative structures as France. Yes, the Cathedral El Oriente are, for me, the most experimental, I think. It's more to tell a story than to explore, yes, new forms of directing. So, but the other have, La Clatana and Mon Père le Diable have to have experimental. So it's the use of the flashbacks, I think, which depict some original aspects, but not very the forms for me. Mm.
Yeah. And Chris, you've been coming to the panel for many years too. I know you've been impressed. We read your Twitter column, so we know you're impressed with the lineup this year. What really is there one film that really stands out for you, or two or three?
Wow, one, huh? Gotta make everybody else feel bad.
That's the way it is. I think the directors love to hear this in a way, because although they have an immediate disappointment if they're not mentioned,
sure,
they really want the truth from the critics.
Sure. No, I can two or three, I think, I can come up with that really stood out for me. I also really liked The Cathedral and its rawness and, you know, this particular kind of Americanness, which perhaps an American doesn't feel too proud of, but is at the same time mesmerized by. I really liked, I'm going to say them in English, I guess. I was very taken with My Father the Devil. I could see that film working as, I mean, it is a thriller of sorts, but I could actually see it being sold as a thriller. You know, a different kind of thriller to be certain. But I found myself very much drawn to it, and the performances and the storytelling in particular. Let's go with one more. I really liked Miracle Child. I was just very, it really, a sense of place and a sense of character,
mm-hmm.
And a certain sadness to it at the same time. And, you know, there are elements of it that I could see, you know, like a young Fellini doing, mm-hmm. for instance, this girl, you know, who, you know, she's a saint, and then she, you know, not to ruin anything, but she becomes a statue. It's kind of shocking in its own way. But I mean, there were things that I liked in certainly in every one of the films as well. I mean, I could go on. Hmm. I'd love to see some of these films find a home in the States. Mm-hmm. It says we know it's a crazy world right now. Hmm. But crazy worlds sometimes open up different kinds of distribution avenues.
Well, Sara, last year you were here and we had just two films, and one of them was a Finnish film. And I'd love to hear from you how well it did when it opened. What was the reaction to it? And were you aware, having been on that panel, that you had a sort of duty to perhaps push that film?
Yes, it was the... Fucking with Nobody, yeah. The autobiographical film. It was a bit of a problem because it was supposed to open in October in Finland, and then we got these COVID really strict measures, so it changed three times the date for the premiere, and then in June the 11th it opened, so it was really late, and so it had maybe it got like a 4-star review from Helsingin Sanomat, which is the biggest Nordic newspaper, and otherwise a bit mixed reviews, but quite good mm-hmm. Generally. And I also wrote that it was really very good. But I think the audience was quite tiny, like 1,900 people or something.
So
the distributor was a bit sad and said that she felt bad, or because she thought it would be bigger. And but she said that the people who had seen it got back to her and they were so, thought it was sort of very brave and funny and like a game changer for the romantic comedy in Finland. So that it was very important to a few people, but not as big as it would have been without the COVID, of course.
Well, during the last year, Glenn, perhaps by coincidence, streaming services have prospered. During COVID, everything from the Criterion Channel to Disney Plus, and I'm assuming that this provides a life looking into the future for the kind of films we've seen this week, that although the theatrical release may be limited, they eventually will be available on disc and in streaming and other.
Availability is kind of a double-edged sword, though, because there's no point in availability if people don't know it's available.
Yeah.
You know, I covered streaming in a column for the New York Times for a few years, and then they said, no, don't do that. You know, it was a weird thing within the purview of the column, too, because at first I started just writing about every interesting streaming service I could find, like Le Cinema Club and Filmatique. Yeah. These are smaller venues that have really fascinating stuff. Kentucker Audley's No Budge. And, you know, I would write about what they were doing. And in the context of a column, it's just sort of hard to keep that going because do you then go back to them again and again and again? At a certain point, I was told, yeah, you know, you've had your fun and now just review 3 Netflix movies a week. And I'm like, okay. Mm. And then I went to a Netflix Christmas party. There is a point to this anecdote. one of the Netflix executives said, yeah, I see you're reviewing individual movies like three at a time in a column. I said, yeah. And he said, we don't like that. I'm like, let me have another canopy and we can talk. But there's this tension between, you know, there's a difficulty involved in keeping up journalistically and what gets covered journalistically and what gets written about and what the streaming sites promote. Criterion's really good about being on social media and promoting their series and features and highlights and stuff. Netflix can't really do that because Netflix just has too much stuff. And it's all, you know, with Amazon, and it has to do with business practices, which are too Byzantine for me to go into here. But with Amazon, it's like a fire sale. And with Netflix, it's like a dumping ground. So, you know, depending on the film. So it's all well and good to have things out there, but it's, you know, if you don't hear about it, it's a problem. I know Notes on an Appearance, Ricky's feature, is on Amazon, which is good. And you should all go watch it. But the point is, and this is a problem, this is a challenge for the Biennale College, too, because I don't think, and it's not the fault of the Biennale College, but I don't think it gets enough attention in the trades. You know, I was looking at a very prominent trade publication, British trade publication, and they were doing their Venice issue, and they have, you know, they have both, they have doing a festival issue, and they have in the back of the book, they have Venice films, they have Toronto films, and in the Venice films, it's pretty much the whole selection, except Biennale College, you know? And I'm like, you've got in the front of the book three, you know, hot take opinion columns. You know, one complaining about why did Locarno give Johnny Depp an award? And in that column, they're saying people feel their voices aren't being heard. I'm like, well, here's six filmmakers whose voices should be heard. Maybe give them a little play here, you know? Mm-hmm. And I was irritated by that. I mean, I know Matt Mueller, he's a good guy, and it's an oversight. But, you know, this is what we're up against, because this is great cinema, but in the parlance of the trades, it's not necessarily sexy, despite how many sex scenes might be in the film. And by the way, Stephanie, I'm going to be like Nancy Reagan with Reza Gorbachev at the Hermitage here. I just want to say this thing. Actually, every film should have a sex scene, just so, yeah. it's required. You know, you have to get the word out. So I want to bang the drum for the Biennale College, which I'll do at RogerEbert.com in one of my diary entries, and I hope my fellow panelists do the same. And I hope we keep banging the drum and get the attention of the trades, a little more attention of the trades. These are new, exciting, dynamic filmmakers with voices that are worth hearing. And, you know, when people talk about the same old, and critics are, you know, critics fall into their own ruts, you know. Many years ago, Steven Soderbergh, who I'm acquainted with, made a two-part, five-hour film about Che Guevara. And he kind of got lambasted in Cannes for it. And he responded, and I think quite sensibly. He says, you know, people are always saying, you know, filmmakers should do new things until you do something new. And, you know, one possible rejoinder was to that was, well, you did something new and it failed. But I don't think that was the case here. It was just too new at the time for them. Olivier Assayas said to me a couple of years later, I could not have made Carlos without the example of Soderbergh's Che. So that's the kind of inter-filmmaker dialogue that creates new things. Yeah. And these are new things. They deserve attention. They warrant attention. So that's my spiel.
And Pierre Eisenreich, you are fortunate enough to live in the city, the one city in the world that has probably more films opening in any quarter than anywhere else. And most of those films are what we would call art house films. So is there a chance for these films that you've seen to get distribution in France, do you think?
I hope for all of them, yes. I hope. What for positive, whatever the quality of the films, we try to review all the films whose filmmaker is distributed for the first time or the second time or third time in France. So it's a duty for us to hope that your movies come to France. There is a lot of festival by us, very important. I told about Angers, Belfort, where Aloriente will go. For the cathedral, I think about Toulouse. It's important for you, all of us, to come to France in our different festival. Then you will see the critics' movies, French movies, which are I don't want to make a relation with the film Les Illusions Perdues from this morning, but there is no interest between critics and distributors in France, but there is a real relation, a real bond, a positive bond between us. So it's important to come in this to this chain.
Thank you. Stephanie, one of the things that that really impressed me about, for example, Aloriente, is the absence of dialogue. There's very little dialogue in it. And we go back to the original purpose and method of film prior to the sound era. And I felt that was very impressive that the whole story was told in a way, in a non-dialogue way. Did you feel this, and perhaps did you feel that the dialogue was important in one or two of the other films?
Well, one thing about El Oriente is that it really demands concentration because of the lack of dialogue, and I think that that's something that is seriously lacking in so many films. Like, so many films just kind of hand you everything, and they don't even invite you to just to slow down and to just, you know, move into the story. And it was one of the things that I loved about that film. Dialogue. One of the things that I loved about Our Happiest Days was how funny it was. And that's something, that's another kind of secret weapon that I think is underused by a lot of filmmakers. Especially sort of early on. I mean, some of you have made several films at this point, but that film was just so delightful, but it's also dealing about what is essentially a painful subject, this idea of the parent becoming the child. As the parent ages, the adult child, is in a situation where he or she has to take care of the parent, and it's the metaphor made literal and visual, which is wonderful. But I just remember watching this movie and just laughing at some of the things that the characters were saying, and this kind of semi-absurd situation that actually felt very natural and believable. I thought it was incredible.
That's absolutely right. It was irrational, but it was like a fairy tale. It worked.
Yeah. It was lovely.
And Savina, coming back to you, I think one of the strengths of the whole program is that you insist on having a team of director and producer. And years ago, when Mike Nichols finally got Final Cut from a studio in Hollywood, it was regarded as a tremendous breakthrough, which it was, but it's been abused so often, not just in Hollywood, but all over the world, where directors release films that are far too long. I mean, even here in Venice, I've seen films which could be cut by 10, 20 minutes without losing anything. Now, how did that concept come about, and how do you operate? How do you find the teams? I mean, is it a time of application? The producer has to make the application, or is it both of them?
That's been central from the beginning. That's also, I guess it's really, it represents the college. We're a bigger team. It really represents another point of view on cinema that is not necessarily only author-driven. That's very difficult. strange to say coming from Europe, but honestly, it is a team effort, and in particular, the figure of the creative producer is more and more important, especially in these kind of films where it's not only a question of time and idea, it's a question of ideas, but also of time and rhythm and, you know, budget. So there's so many elements, and they're both, these two figures are both so important. Mm. So honestly, the program wouldn't exist if it wasn't for teams. Mm. If the teams by any chance falls apart, the film is not made. We're not going to support it. So I can say that there's been in the past a number of sometimes difficult moments between the director and the producer, and it's always been solved. But if it hadn't been solved, that would not have... It's not that the Biennale would then back one of the two. It wouldn't happen. And we do evaluate how the team works together in pushing them forward in the program. So the application is quite complex, and it has to be done by the team together. We're also asking a preliminary budget that, of course, makes no sense if in principle, because we're accepting treatments, ideas, but what we want to see is that you've thought through the process of how am I going to do this with 150,000 euros. Of course, that budget is never going to be the same as the final budget of the film, but we want the applicants to know what they're going into. Mm-hmm. And you need the team for that. You need that constant dialogue between the director and the producer to be able to do something like this. So from the outset, I mean, the application couldn't be done by the director alone. And if they don't come both, we don't accept them. We go to the waiting list.
You mentioned right at the beginning that you had to do a lot of work online this year because of COVID. But would you agree that the concept of having a team come to Venice for up to 10 days and to meet with experts and go over their script and so on is a crucial part of the program? I mean, will that come back when COVID is over?
Oh, absolutely. We're hoping. We don't know what we're going to do this year. It really depends. Absolutely. The fact of being together, also we have this very special place. Very special place where we're isolated, but then Venice is just a step away. So, and the fact of being there night and day and all together discussing also during lunch, breakfast, that's amazing. Yeah. But I must say that a hybrid solution is also fantastic because we run three workshops. One is for the 12 teams, and it's the longest one. It's the 10-day. And definitely that one has to be in presence. The second one is for the four selected teams, and that's 5 days, and that is also quite important that we're all together. But if we look at the third workshop that we normally did in presence, we actually saw that because it's sort of a pre-production workshop, doing it online might be beneficial because for the producer to be in their territories and close to where they're going to shoot in the 2 months after might be better. So we have actually learned from this experience, and we're trying to change the program in this way, so doing a hybrid. But the physical presence, I mean, it's quite obvious. We need it. We need it, and we're going to try and make it possible every time we can. So that's what we're hoping for this year, to do the first and second in presence and the third online.
Chris, one final question before we bring in the teams. It's great that women directors are more and more to the forefront here in Venice, which was one of the last festivals, possibly mainstream, to bring in female talent. And of course, among these films, we've had all these women directors. Did you notice that? Were you aware of any difference compared with previous years when you first came to the panel?
Yeah, I noticed that there were certainly, I think, more than I've been coming here since 2015, I think. I certainly noticed as I was going over the bios of the different filmmakers that there's, I think that in many ways, diversity has gone more to the forefront. And I think that's reason to celebrate. Frankly.
I think all three, My Father the Devil and Happiest Year and La Tana all bring a specificity of perspective that is notable in terms of women filming.
Yeah, Our Happiest Days, too, yeah. So now we have with us the directors and producers of the films. They're all hiding behind masks, so forgive me if I don't recognize all of you. But I would like to, maybe I can ask the first question, which is about El Oriente, with director and producer of El Oriente. You put your hands. There you are, right in front. That this was of particular interest to me because I love that part of Latin America, and I haven't been to Ecuador, I've been to Peru and Colombia, and I thought that you produced, you really brought alive the atmosphere of the small towns and also the way that people lead their lives in the country, and this contrast of between people being paid very, very little. And this desperate quest for gold is almost like the John Huston's Treasure of the Sierra Madre. There's a certain almost risibility about it because you know in the end that it's going to end in disaster, probably. And I was particularly taken by the end of your film. Now, I thought at the time it's abrupt. It ends suddenly. You're not really prepared. They find this house. He's left with just one companion, and suddenly the film ends. What do you want us to think happens to Atahualpa?
Thank you for your question.
Are there microphones? I think that, yeah, there's a microphone that would be easier for you.
Well, regarding the ending of the film, I feel like the metaphor of the treasure is a very vast metaphor that we can let us talk a lot about other issues in our contemporary lives, like work, earning money. Is also something regarding to capitalism somehow. There's some treasure we are looking for that never seems to become true. Yeah. And the scene in the ending of our film, it has much to be with that, because they were looking for this supposed treasure that's supposed to be there, and what they found is not a treasure. It's like the
headman, gold.
Like, not gold, but the beginning of our society, like that is set in violence. In violence between men and between mainly men, but and how that conforms this capitalist society in which we live, is said in that a rush for the gold. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, and I think our character that somehow along the whole film has some kind of a passive role. Mm-hmm. He's trying to figure out what to do, where to go, and he's lost. Finally, he can make a step away from the direction he should keep going, and that's the last action of the film. It's a step away from that.
Yes.
No, we don't know where, but not the same.
Okay. That helps me. Ellie Tumbi, can I ask you, Ellie Tumbi, about Mon Père le Diable? There's a wonderful line in it where we hear that there's no good or bad in the jungle. There's just death and life. And that seemed to me an essential theme of the film, an undercurrent. You found words in the dialogue, I thought, which were very, very, very accurate at the time they're said. It's a film about crime and punishment, but also forgiveness, I think. And, there's a bitterness that runs through the central characters, but there's also this need for forgiveness, for redemption.
Yes, definitely. I mean, I think in looking at the crime punishment aspect of it, and I mean, we're exploring characters that are dealing with things that happened 20 years prior, things that happened in the past before the film actually starts. And so for me, when you know, exploring that trauma and exploring what happened in war, especially with children who are child soldiers, and you know, it's about survival. And so some of the actions that are taken are primarily about survival. And I think even carrying that into the present with these characters that are still trying to survive what they've experienced and trying to find a way to exist and to move forward in their lives in a way that's possible for them. For me, it was a very difficult film to write because I'm at the same time trying to put myself in the shoes of these characters and trying to ask myself these difficult questions of how does one take a step forward? How does one try to put their lives back together? And, you know, in some ways the characters kind of took on a life of their own, and I let the chips fall where they did.
The acting, I think, in all the films, I think we all agree, but it was excellent. And Beatrice Baldacci, where's Beatrice? In La Tana, which I particularly liked, I think you found this actress who plays this mysterious young woman. And she has you just watch her the whole time because you're wondering what she will reveal. Is she trying to do harm to this man, or is she really a lost soul? Someone who, I think there's a line in the film that said, she never bloomed because she was ashamed of herself. But I thought that the character was really, really good. And how did you find that actress?
I find Irene Vetere in another film, and I love her because she is very interesting and also a dark, mysterious girl with beautiful eyes. It's very perfect for the character.
Yeah, that's right. It was very effective. And also your use of this the academy type ratio. Why did you choose that?
To concentrate the attention to the emotion of the characters,
right.
And to take Giulio and Lia more near and a confronto, come si dice.
Yeah, and more near, but also like opposite. Yes, so both for this reason. Also, it's a narrow, so yeah. Like suffocating.
Claustrophobic atmosphere, yes. Yeah. And Saul Barreto, Prenon Riviere, yes, that's right, we met before. Hi. Could we have the microphone over here?
Hi.
How did you find the child actress?
The little girl.
Yeah.
Well, I did a previous film that is mainly played by little girls, which is called Mom, Mom, Mom. Okay. I also did it with my fairy, as I call her, because she, as Sabina said, to me it's a partnership, and it's... it's my marriage, my artistic marriage with her, I say, because this is my second film, and it's also with her. And we found her in my previous film, but she played she wasn't the main character in the previous film, but I felt in love with her, and everybody who watched the previous film always pointed out about her. Yeah. And so when I met her, she was six. She was turning 6 years old. And when she shoot Nuestros Días Más Felices, she was 8, I think.
Oh, okay.
8. Yeah. So I found her in my previous film.
Okay. Thank you. Ricky D'Ambrose. Ricky, can I ask you a question about something which initially troubled me a lot in the cathedral, but I got used to it, which is the off-screen narration, which is a device that's been used, of course, throughout the cinema and in masterpieces like Barry Lyndon. I felt that too much information was coming at me in too short a time. I lost track of who was related to who, but when the narration came back later in the film, I thought it made a lot more sense. But what made you at the outset decide to have off-screen narration?
I think it was because I wanted to find. I'm going to just make this. I wanted to find a way to give the viewer a distance upon what they're watching, providing a frame for the viewer rather than making a kind of sentimental. Movie about a family.
Yeah.
I think because the film is based on my own memories and based on people I know, in some way having the third person distant figure who has no relationship to these people whatsoever is a way of allowing me to have another perspective on people who are actually people I grew up with. And that I think would have been just speaking kind of like psychotherapeutically, it would have been much more challenging to make a movie in which, for me personally as a filmmaker, in which that glass pane wasn't put up.
Okay, that makes sense. Yeah, thank you. And Sylvia Brunelli? Hi, Sylvia. We didn't meet before, I don't think. But having seen the Paolo Sorrentino film about Naples, and your film set in Naples.
Yeah.
Is this a new trend? I mean, it seems a wonderful place in which, a wonderful city in which to make movies, a wonderful environment with everything going on so fast, so quick that you have to race to catch up with it. Did you write from the beginning, say, yes, I want to have this story in Naples?
Yeah. Yes, because Naples is a city, a very special city. It's full of conflict and contradiction, and my movie is a movie that lives of contradiction. There are magic elements and sacred elements, profane elements, and Naples is a city full of color, full of sadness, full of a tragic situation, but also is a there is a typical culture that it's very, very special, and this movie it's for that kind of city. There is not a city like Naples in Italy, and this story is about Naples and Neapolitan people.
Is the superstition in Naples more more preeminent than other Italian area?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, they live on this kind of of this. Yeah, it's a sort of mix between spiritual life and superstitious life. Mm-hmm. So it's very strange. And they live under the shadow of the Vesuvio, the volcano, and there is a kind of god, but it's just a volcano. So it's very strange, but they are special for this kind of stuff. Yeah.
So are there questions that any of you, the panelists, would like to address to the directors and producers? This is a great opportunity, I think, for interaction. So far away, Pierre just asked something.
Yes, to tell about the forms that about what you asked to me. In the cathedral, you talk very it's very good the reference to Barry Lyndon, but I thought for the form I saw a cinematography near Roy Anderson. Is it a filmmaker that you like very much?
No.
No. In the distance, the what?
Oh, no, this is not. I can see. Hmm. I mean, I can see the comparison. I think one of I can talk about references from other filmmakers, but also one of the guiding visual components of the movie is a whole lot of family photographs. The way people took 35mm snapshot photos in the late 80s, early 90s, these kind of tableau-style photographs. And in certain instances, not just hair and makeup and props, but the way people are arranged in the frame and the distance the camera has from the people is drawn from those that kind of scrapbook family album I used during pre-production.
Okay. Another question from the panel? Uh-huh. Or a question from the filmmakers to the panel? No one wants to talk?
You have to warn the critic.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, we've had many panels like this where critics have not liked at least two or three of the films, and we've equally had panels about which involve films which we all liked enormously. Like in the very first one, there was an Italian film, A Man Who Swam Underwater All the Time. What was it? Yeah, it was an excellent film. And then last year, The Art of Return by Pedro Colantes. I saw it online, then I went to see it with the public. I liked it so much. And the public premiere was a triumph, a standing ovation, you know. And yet this film has not been distributed. Just not been distributed. It opened in Spain. It went to a few minor festivals, and that's it. Life is very tough, it can seem, for some of the films, and that seems unjust.
I want to say I was very gratified when This Is Not a Burial, This Is a Resurrection, yeah, got American distribution. And I teach film at NYU, and the last couple of semesters I've been teaching it virtually, so I get a lot of students from different places around the world, South Asia. And it's weird, because I'm like, why doesn't administration do something so that these kids in South Asia don't have to get up at 3 in the morning to take this class? But, you know, that's not my purview overall. But there was one student from Rio in Brazil who is one of my more brilliant students. He worships Glauber Rocha. And when I met him in person recently, he was wearing that Glauber Rocha hat. That was adorable. But we were talking about film convention and how stale it was. And we were talking about the work of Khalid Gala, who I've written about. But then we were talking about other work that has the radicalism that he aspires to and he thinks cinema should aspire to. I said, there's a film you should see called This Is Not a Burial, It's a Revolution. And he said, that's it. I've seen it. That's the film. That's the only film. So, you know, it is getting out there.
And Savina, in recent years, you've put an emphasis on the Italian participation. I understand that because it's a program based in Italy. But what has been the response in Italy to these films? Do they all get distribution within Italy?
The truth is no. They don't all get distribution within Italy. No.
Despite the language. I guess I was getting at that in the language, you didn't have to worry about subtitles.
Yeah, but it's, of course, some do, but it's really something very difficult to know in advance. I really wish that this could become easier. In some cases, it's better also in Italy to go directly to. There's two new digital platforms that have opened, and in Mio Cinema, there's some incredible situations that I think we should use at this point because of because of what's happening, but also because of how distribution is, mm-hmm. is in Italy. Honestly, I think it's one of the most difficult countries. I mean, if we compare it to our to France, or like we're in another world in that sense, and it's not a good situation.
Mm-hmm. But so, you have some good distributors of international films, like Lucky Red, and
yes,
they have people who take a risk on films.
Yes, but there's some particular films that are very difficult to distribute. But what is also good is we do have some theaters that do some incredible jobs, so they create mm-hmm. a circuit. And that is also another possibility
Moretti show any of these films?
I think he would. I'm not particularly aware of him having shown any one of our films. But what we can say is we try. I must say we cannot work on national distribution in general. What we do is we do facilitate and help these films get ready for international to get a sales agent on board. In fact, the program also gives you the possibility of meeting marketing and sales agents before, and also we help with the trailer and the poster. So we try to help them access, you know, international distribution so that they don't have to worry necessarily of all of those elements while shooting the film and doing everything in 11 months. But and the situation is getting better and better year after year. In fact, if you think of the first 3 or 4 editions, we had no film that had distribution while arriving in Venice. While now each year there's at least half have distribution already. So that's they come in Venice with distribution. In some cases it's come after. And in some cases also a lot after. I'm thinking of Beautiful Things. And that's an Italian film that got distributed. And it didn't have a sales agent for at least 8 months. Didn't know where it would open. Then it went on to Copenhagen, won one of the main awards there. And then it became an internet.
It was 2 years ago, right?
Beautiful Things, no, it was more. It was 2017.
2017.
That film then continued to travel for a couple of years after, and but it took some time. So what I'm saying to the filmmakers, I didn't have a chance, but be patient, because it's not that it has to happen immediately. It can, in these times, also happen after several months. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. I'm thinking of also how films like Bianca, and The Fitz, Memphis,
Blanc,
gradually filtered into distribution of one.
But you are
another.
Yes, you are talking about films that were highly successful in terms of distribution, like also. So Blanca, for example, is one of the the one Hotel Salvation. That was a film that went on for I think 3 years after.
That was an Indian film.
Indian film that was film. Probably the most successful in terms of distribution and festivals. I think it went to over 50 festivals around the world.
That was a very good film. Very good. So any questions? Any answers? Groucho would say. Yeah? Anybody from the audience? We have microphones. Anybody want to ask a question? Of the critics or of the directors? No? Everyone shy? How many people have seen any of the films that we've been talking about? Who's here? I mean, have any of the public seen the films yet? Yeah? One hand. One? Not enough. You must try and go for the repeat screenings.
You must see them.
Yeah.
Still, 3 to go, and the others, they're having their 3rd screenings in these days. So there's still a lot of opportunities to see them all.
Yeah,
check the program.
Yeah,
check also, if you have to walk to Teatro Astra in some cases.
Yeah, you can go to the Astra. It's down by the Elisabetta.
You have to walk there, but it's worth it.
Well, any more? Anybody like any concluding remarks from our friends, particularly stateside? Chris, any comment now you've been back? You notice the difference between these films and the films you saw before COVID, before when you were last here?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you mean from the? I mean, there's
quality.
I'm just thinking of differences between what I've been seeing. Not from previous
that too.
Biennale colleges, but just from Yeah, it's really nice to see. What I've seen lately has really been funneled through a pretty narrow distribution pipe. I don't live in New York. You know, I don't live in Los Angeles. I live in Houston. City like Houston, real big city, but has been hit really hard as far as, you know, their main art house is closed. Mm. Just because of business, mm-hmm. during it just couldn't withstand,
yeah.
the virus. Mm-hmm. And then there's the Museum of Modern Art in Houston does pretty well as far as distribution, but I guess what I'm trying to say is that it's nice to get a strong helping of art. So, I see art films, but again, they're about, you know, they've made it through this narrow distribution avenue already, and it's nice to see films that are, you know, maybe not there yet as far as reaching the public, but are, you know, very much adventurous and, a real voice in all of these films. I've been watching too much Netflix. That's another way of putting it.
Yeah.
It's a real pleasure to be here, and it's a real pleasure to see all of your work.
Well, I think in summing up, we can say that this has been an absolute triumph. It's a triumph that we have 6 films of such quality. It's a triumph that the filmmakers are all here. They all managed to get here. That our American friends spent 10 hours in a mask and went through endless lines of officialdom in order to get here. And that everybody is alive and watching films. And let's hope next year we'll have a more normal year. We'll have 4 films, right, Sabina? 4 films. And let's hope we all meet again next year. Thank you for coming.
Fred Film Radio, 24/7 on Fred.fm and smartphone apps.